You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 6th to the 12th of August 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan, reporters Ellie Bothwell and Chris Havergal, and Books Editor Karen Shook. The OECD has hit something of a wall in its bid to introduce what's been dubbed a PISA for universities, sort of testing out what universities in different parts of the world teach. But who's blocking the EHALO project and why? John Morgan's been looking into one theory in this week's Splash. Chris Havergal will be reporting back from the inaugural THE Africa University Summit, which took place in Johannesburg last week. We'll be finding out which university has produced the most Nobel Prize winners, and indeed from which countries the most laureates hail. Ellie's been looking into that. And Karen has our regular roundup of the books section. But first, John, our splash this week looks at EHALO. It's a project to compare what students at different countries' universities learn, and it's not going very smoothly.
That's right. So this is the OECD's project to find out what students at different universities around the world know and can do when they graduate by bringing out a standardised test that would be used internationally. And the OECD has said to member nations that it'd like to know by, well, it said earlier this year, would like to know by 31st of May whether they wanted to take part and take it to a full project. But it looks like it's going to be bad news for the OECD and the project won't get off the ground. As we've already reported at THE, England has already said it won't take part. So I spoke to Hamish Coates, who's Chair of Higher Education at the University of Melbourne, and he led the OECD's feasibility study on EHALO. And I asked him about the opposition to the project, and he told me that what's happening is the established oligopoly isn't keen to be disrupted by the new order, the new commercial order of higher education. What we're seeing happen is essentially the legacy providers, who are very dominant in the research space, trying to prevent new information about education coming to light. So he's obviously being very critical of the established sort of research elite of universities. He said these were principally in the Anglosphere, so in the US, in the UK, in Canada. And he's saying they're standing in the way of something that actually would be a very good thing, because for parents around the world, they want to know about the cost, quality and prospects of higher education when they're thinking about, you know, where to send their son or daughter. And he also argued that we need information about the quality of learning if governments are going to have policies about improving higher education. And his case was backed up by someone else I spoke to. It's Dwayne Matthews of the Lumina Foundation, which is a US body that funds a lot of higher education projects and provided funding for EHALO. And he agreed that higher education is not interested in being externally accountable for its results. And he also blamed the most selective institutions. He would be particularly talking about the US.
So self-interest winning out, really, over arguably over public interest. But I mean, what would be in it for these institutions? I mean, it's no surprise, is it? If it's not compulsory, if it's something you can choose to do, or simply say, eh, no, you're all right, thanks very much. It's no surprise, is it, that they've simply said, no, I think we've got enough accountability and we'll stick with what we've got.
I mean, even the OECD says that it probably, you know, might be a bit of a blow to the reputation of the established world leaders in the US and UK. So yes, you could understand why they would oppose it, but I think the OECD would say that ultimately, yeah, you might take a short term hit possibly, but in the long run, it really is important to have this information about the quality of learning that goes on.
Is it dead in the water, EHALO?
It definitely seems to be that way. That the OECD have said that they're going to sort of reveal a final decision probably in September, but all the indications seem to be that it's not going to happen, and England not taking part is a big blow. And instead, what seems to be the case is that there'll be national projects to look at learning gain and learning outcomes instead of international ones, and that's what's happening in England at the moment.
Indeed. Well, follow that story on page 6 and 7 in the magazine and at timeshighereducation.co.uk. Perhaps some of the universities not among the traditional elite are located in Africa. Chris, you were out there last week to cover the THE's inaugural Africa Universities Summit. Plenty of coverage in this week's magazine, even more online, a big success. What did you take away from your time out there?
I think this was a couple of days which showed the extent of the challenges that Africa's universities face, but also which demonstrated the appetite to tackle those challenges and the role which these universities could play in the development of the continent. There were delegates from 22 countries attending at the University of Johannesburg, and the event started with an address by Thabo Mbeki, the former South African president. It would be very easy for former presidents to turn up at these sorts of events and just say niceties and, you know, pat everyone on the back. But actually, what he did was give a very challenging speech about the relationship between universities and governments in Africa, which he said had become impoverished and marginalised in part because universities were viewed as serving as centres of political opposition to the elite, and said that universities needed to demonstrate that they were central to the development of Africa to rebuild that relationship with government. And that set the tone, really, for the event. Development was a very big theme. We heard a call from the director of the United Nations African Institute for Economic Development and Planning, saying that universities should rediscover their public mission in Africa, raising concerns about the explosion of private for-profit providers in the continent. And we also heard about a range of other challenges: research collaboration, funding, and in particular the brain drain of academics. So many African young scholars leave Africa to pursue their careers in Europe, the US, the rest of the world, and looking at ways in which that flow could be stemmed. And in particular, a call for universities to shun mediocrity was what we were told. Academics won't come back or stay in Africa until they can be convinced that it's good for their careers.
There was a bit of do as I say, not do as I do, wasn't there, about the conference? A lot of the prestigious speakers we had indeed had spent a lot of their time overseas, then come back to the conference and urge the next generation not to do what they've done.
Yes, it's a bit of a funny one, that is, but I think attitudes in Africa are changing a bit towards that. I think there's beginning to be a recognition, or at least people are calling for there to be a recognition, that if Africa is to develop, it needs to be part of this global game, and it needs to accept that there'll be a bit of flow of scholars between Africa and the rest of the world. But on that subject, I think while Africa at the conference, it was very clear it needed to be part of that globalised world, I think there's very clear recognition that the solutions for Africa's higher education system definitely needed to be led by African voices and views. So this wasn't something where solutions that worked in the rest of the world would necessarily be replicated. That's just the same part of the discussion of the conference was about a Times Higher Education ranking, which could be introduced for the Africa region. But again, they're emphasising the importance of having measures which reflect their missions and their roles in development, and not holding them to the same sort of research-dominated standards as the West.
Indeed. Well, you can follow all of that coverage from the conference on our website. Click the World News tab. But moving on, Ellie, this week you've been covering Nobel Prize winners. We've been crunching some numbers. We've produced a couple of tables looking at, two things principally, sort of where Nobel Prize winners have been scholars and indeed where they were born in the first place. What did you find out?
Yeah, absolutely. So we found that, perhaps unsurprisingly, the US has dominated both of these tables. So Stanford University is the top institution in terms of producing Nobel Prize winners in the 21st century. That institutional list, it's a top 10, and 8 of them are from the US. So the other table is for the nationality of prize winners, as you said, and the US again comes out on top. The two institutions that aren't in the US are Max Planck Society and Technion Israel Institute of Technology, which are both interesting ones. Technion isn't one that is always sort of as high up on league tables, but it's obviously giving scholars the sort of freedom and creativity needed to produce research that is Nobel Prize worthy. And there are no UK institutions on the list, which is a bit of a blow, but the UK does do well in terms of the nationality of winners. It's number two on that table.
Yeah, so number two in terms of nationality, but presumably this indicates that a lot of UK scholars are doing this work overseas or in other countries.
Some of them have done it in other countries. I think there were, overall 13 UK institutions have produced Nobel Prize winners in the 21st century. Not enough to make our top 10. Some of these are overseas, and you know, sort of series of funding cuts. Might increase this overseas activity further. Maybe institutions in the UK sort of need to be providing more money and more freedom for their academics, so that they can actually claim Nobel Prize winners in the future.
Indeed, yeah. And well, you can follow all that on page 8. There's even more coverage online again of this story. I'll go into a bit more detail on the website, so do check it out there. Moving on, though, Karen, you've been producing podcasts yourself in the last week, and also, of course, the regular book section for the magazine. What can listeners find out from our books roundup this week?
Well, I'm just recovering from the excitement of having a books podcast last week featuring not one but two academic authors, Jenny Bristow from Canterbury Christchurch University, and from the Policy Institute at King's College London and formerly Westminster, David Willits. So if this podcast is not enough, scoot over to that one. This week in the books pages, Mary Evans of the LSE reviews Paula Birkinshaw's book, Higher Education, Leadership and Women Vice-Chancellors. Paula's written for us in the past in the features section on this issue of women leaders in higher education, and she considers whether leadership training is what is needed. Mary points out that this can be problematic. It can tend to suggest that this view suggests that the excluded rather than those who exclude should do the work. Bambos Kiriakou at the University of Leicester has reviewed what he calls a game changer and a masterpiece in biology. This is John Parrington's book, The Deeper Genome, Why There Is More to the Human Genome Than Meets the Eye. He suggests it's going to be on a lot of reading lists, and he thought it was fantastic. Jacqueline Broad from Monash makes her debut in our pages. She reviews Hilary Gatti's book, Ideas of Liberty in Early Modern Europe, From Machiavelli to Milton. In between Machiavelli and Milton, Jacqueline says there's not too many women featuring in this book. And she thinks that is, in an otherwise excellent work, perhaps a shortcoming. Duncan Wu's been a long-time contributor to our pages. Mm-hmm. He was stolen away to the University of Georgetown a few years back. He's a noted romantic scholar. He's written a book for Wiley Blackwell called 30 Great Myths About the Romantics, and there's obviously no one better placed than he to look at that. In case you're wondering what they are, things like, was Blake mad? Was Keats gay? Was Wordsworth a Tory? Was De Quincey a drug addict? I don't know where they got that idea. If you want to know whether the real Lord Byron was a flabby, effeminate man who liked wigs, jewelry, and adolescent boys, you will have to read the book.
And who doesn't want to know?
Indeed, exactly. And our book of the week this week, it's a huge honour to be presenting another landmark work from a scholar who is in her 92nd year. That's Baroness Warnock of Wyke, Mary Warnock, part of the Oxbridge's wartime generation of brilliant female philosophers, including Elizabeth Anscombe, Iris Murdoch, and Philippa Foot. She's also known for chairing the Committee of Inquiry into Human Fertilization of Embryology. And her new book, our book of the week this week, reviewed by Jane O'Grady, is Critical Reflections on Ownership. And Warnock suggests that the way birds build and embellish and defend their nests is a natural symbol for property owning. And another amazing work from a very late career scholar.
Thank you, Karen. Brilliant. Well, that's all for this week's podcast. I should flag up our cover feature as well. In it, we have asked academics to reveal the worst piece of feedback that they've received as part of anonymous peer review, not to be missed, page 30 and online as well. But that's all for this week's Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on any of the stories in this week's magazine, you can do so by going to that website I've just given you. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+, all the usual places, and we'd love to hear from you. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.